It is my great honor and pleasure to welcome His Holiness Radhanath Swami Maharaj here today to grace this occasion. Some of you may have heard of His Holiness Radhanath Swami Maharaj as an ISKCON spiritual leader, and others may have heard of him as the author of the much acclaimed book called The Journey Home. Well, he is both the above, but he is much, much more than all that. Swamiji is truly inspirational, and his life has inspired thousands of people to do something more with their lives. His journey began more than 40 years ago, when Swamiji was a young boy living in Chicago. At the age of 19, he had this burning desire to do something more with his life. And that set him off on the journey all the way to India. It was an arduous journey, difficult one, with a lot of trials and tribulations. He hitchhiked over 4,000 miles right through Europe and Asia to come to the borders of India. And since then, he has made India his home. And for the last 40 years, Swamiji has been inspiring people to come together, to do something for the greater good of mankind and God. And people from different backgrounds, different socio-economic groups, different skill sets have all come together and have worked beautifully, harmoniously in all the projects that Swamiji has set up. And I would like to name a few of his projects. To start with, the midday meal scheme, which caters to thousands of underprivileged children studying in municipal schools. They're given a free midday meal. And currently, the midday meal program is feeding over 12 lakh children all across India. Then there is the Bhaktivedanta Hospital, which is the hospital for holistic health care. Then the Bhaktivedanta Hospice, which is catering to terminally ill patients who are in the last stages of their life, to give them relief, to give them support. Then there is the Barsana Rural Eye Camp, which caters to doing thousands of free cataract operations for the poor, impoverished villagers in the heart of northern India. And finally, the Govardhan Eco Village, which is the eco-friendly spiritual retreat that Swamiji has inspired people to create, which inculcates the principles of simple living in harmony with nature. Apart from this, Swamiji has been giving talks in so many universities, inspiring both the young and old, and he has spoken in Harvard, in MIT, in NYU, UMass, to name just a few. Swamiji has also he's been invited to have discussions with world leaders like Barack Obama, our Indian President, Honorable Pratibha Patil, and spiritual leaders like Dalai Lama, Mother Teresa, and others. And recently, Swamiji has addressed an arm of the House of Commons of the British Parliament and was given a standing ovation. I could go on all evening, but I think we will turn the evening over to His Holiness Radhanath Swami and hear pearls of wisdom. Thank you so much for gracing the occasion.
Thank you. So grateful to be with all of you this evening. Special, special gratitude to Anu and Sunil for opening the doors of this beautiful home. And your daughter's name is?
Arna.
Arna? And to Arna for opening the doors to your beautiful home for us to gather tonight. And to all of you, from what I understand, you are all very busy, busy people. And to take this time, I'm very honored. Thank you. There's nothing more precious in life than each moment we have to live. And how we utilize each moment is what will determine the meaning of our life. I was last year, I experienced something that I'd just like to share with you. How people in the world are really being polarized. Greed and selfishness is expanding like we've never seen it. All the problems in Wall Street, so much corruption. And at the same time, people who see these things, so many are asking serious questions. What is the use of having so much power, so much wealth, so much influence, if we don't have inner fulfillment? I was invited to speak at the Mike Milken Global Conference in Beverly Hills just last year. And about 4,000 of very top world leaders were there. Leaders in finance, leaders in politics, leaders in entertainment, many fields. And they gathered together, and there's many seminars. They asked me to do a morning meditation every day at 6:30 in the morning. I was surprised how many of these people got up at 6:30 to come to. But it was very special. I went to one particular conference that they had, which was probably the most popular. It was a panel on leadership in business and finances and politics in the world. And they had, I don't know if you've heard of these people. As a Swami living in India, I really never heard of them until I met them. But there was Mike Milken, who was a very, very powerful, influential person in America. And then there was Steve Wynn, who's probably the biggest hotel owner and casino owner in the world. He owns most of Las Vegas and so many other places. And there was the CEO and president of Safeway Foods, I think the largest food store in America. And there was a lady who was the CEO and president of a pharmaceutical research company that came up with more cures and aids to cancer than anyone else. And there was the ex-manager of the New York Yankees, which is a very famous baseball team. You all know baseball? It's kind of like a corrupted version of cricket from an Indian perspective. But each one was introduced on a big screen. For this particular seminar, there were 2,000 people and a big banquet. They were all sitting and listening. And the idea was, what is leadership? I was very fascinated. Steve Wynn, he's a vegetarian. He's a vegan, as is Mike Milken. In his talk, he quoted Mahatma Gandhi four times. One of the quotes was that, "There goes my people. They are ahead of me, and I must follow them because I am their leader." And the culmination of the whole conference was putting on the screen, and he spoke Gandhi's words, "You must be the change you want to see in the world." When it came to Joe Torre, Mike Milken said, "Please tell us," he was asking all these people, "what is the most fulfilling accomplishment you have made in your life?" And he explained that the New York Yankees, they were not in a single playoff in 10 years. And then the owners of the team hired Joe Torre, who was a Hall of Fame baseball player, to be the manager. And the news media and press throughout America blasted the Yankees for this decision. They said, "This man is useless. He is incompetent." They said so many terrible things about him. But in the next 10 years, the New York Yankees were in 6 championships and they won 4 world champions. And he was rated one of the 5 top baseball managers in the history of baseball. So they asked, "What was the most fulfilling accomplishment that you have in your life?" And he looked at this lady who cured people of cancer. He said, "Compared to her sitting next to me, she cures people of cancer. I've done nothing." Mike Milken said, "Well, you may say that, but out of the 2,000 people, there must be at least 1,500 New York Yankee fans out there." And everybody, it costs $5,000 to get into that conference. But Swamis get in for free, actually. I'm the first Swami they ever invited. In fact, my talk was the first religious or spiritual event they ever had in all their years. But anyways, he said, "You know, we believe you've accomplished some things. Please tell us." And he said, and he became very, very emotional. Tears were in his eyes. And he began to tell his life story. He said, "When I was a boy, growing up in New York City, my father was an alcoholic, and my family was so abusive. There was nothing but pain and suffering day and night. There was so much fighting and so much pressure and so much anger." He said, "I suffered so bad." He said, "The only shelter I had, I would take all of my frustration out in playing baseball. In the street, in the empty lots, wherever, in the alleys." He was from a poor family. He said, "It was the only way I could vent my frustration, and it was the only way I could forget my suffering. And because I went so deep into it, I became a Hall of Fame baseball player. And when I was hired by the New York Yankees, everybody was criticizing me." And he said, "If you want to be successful, never let the media discourage you." He said, "That's one lesson I'd like to tell you." And then he said, "After I retired from the New York Yankees," he said, "I started an organization to help children from abusive homes. We set up offices in various public schools in the ghettos and other places. where we have psychiatrists and psychologists, and we have therapy, and we actually give people something that I never got. I never felt loved. I never felt appreciated. I never felt valued. I never felt encouraged. Just the opposite. That's all I got in my house. And I suffered. And we give these children that. And we see their lives changing. He said, winning World Series, being in the Hall of Fame, getting millions of dollars for doing these things means nothing compared to helping these children. And then he said, and I have to confess to you, this whole organization was my wife's idea. It wasn't even mine. I'm just assisting her. And I was listening. And usually swamis don't listen to, you know, baseball managers talking about their lives. But I was moved. Because what really brings meaning and fulfillment to life? Not things. Things can give some pleasure to the mind and some pleasure to the senses of the body, but things cannot touch the heart. Only love can touch the heart. To give love and to receive love. The Vedanta Sutra, Brahma Sutra, tells Anandamayo Vyashat that the essential quality of all living beings is we are seeking pleasure. Everyone needs pleasure. The little cockroach that's crawling around in your kitchen is just looking for pleasure. The elephant in the jungle. I was recently, last week, in Rishikesh, and they have these big signs in the forest, beware of danger, beware of wild elephants. And they have photographs of elephants knocking over cars. The elephant's just looking for pleasure. And whatever our particular role in life is, we're trying to find pleasure and we're trying to avoid that which interferes with pleasure, which is called pain. But the real pleasure of the heart is what moves us. A meaningful, fulfilling life of learning how to love and be loved. If you have everything but no one to love or be loved by, it's like an empty shell, like a husk of rice without rice inside. And I saw this in some of these incredibly successful people, and it just brought me back to our own holy scriptures. Not only the Vedas, but all the great holy scriptures of the world. It is described in Bible that the first and great commandment is to love God with all your heart, mind, and soul, and to love your neighbor as yourself. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, it tells us, Savai pung sang paro dharmo yato bhaktir hokshate. That the supreme dharma for all living beings at all times is to awaken the dormant love that is within our heart. And how is that love manifested? Through seva, through unselfish service, through compassion. There's nothing greater and more fulfilling to the heart than being an instrument of God's compassion within this world. And that's actually Raja Vijja Rajaguyan Pavitramita Mutamam. It's the most secret of all secrets. It's so obvious, but so few people understand it. How to actually nourish the heart of ourselves, of our family, and of others in this world. That is a meaningful life. Helen Keller was blind, deaf, and dumb. And she was one of the greatest inspirations in the world as far as wisdom. And she wrote, I don't know if she actually wrote it, but she somehow or other she communicated that the beautiful things in life are not things that could be seen or touched or heard. They're things that are felt in the heart. And when we listen to Hari Katha, when we hear beautiful, meaningful speeches or talks, its greatness is not just how it nourishes our intellect, but how it transforms our heart, how it touches our heart, how it awakens something deep within us. In the Srimad Bhagavad, it describes that if you water the root of the tree, naturally every part of the tree is nourished. The leaves, the branches, the twigs, the flowers. If you try to water each leaf and branch and flower, it just makes it a little shiny, but it doesn't really go deep. And Krishna, or the Supreme Lord, who has many names, is that root of existence. Aham sarvasya prabhavo matta sarvam pravartate. And when we awaken that love, then naturally that love extends toward every living being. From an actual spiritual perspective of seeking the essence of whatever scripture it may be, it is impossible to love God and dislike anyone. We may not like a disease of our mother or father, or brother or sister, but we love our brother and father. Mother and father, brother, sister. And this is true spirituality. To actually learn how to love. You know, I was just speaking with this wonderful gentleman about, your name again is?
Ajay.
He was telling me this incredible story about what he does. 200 million people he's already arranged to participate in this project where they take fingerprints and your eyes and they give you an identity. Because most people in India, they have no way to prove who they are. From a spiritual perspective, and this is the basis of the Gita and all the scriptures, to understand our eternal identity. Jesus says in the Bible, what is the gain if you gain the whole world but you lose your eternal soul? This is the basic foundational principle of spiritual knowledge. Najayate mriyate vakadachit. Who am I? I'm seeing through my eyes, I'm hearing through my ears, I'm tasting and speaking through my tongue, I'm thinking through my brain, feeling through my heart. But who is that I? I'm not an I, I'm seeing through my eye. I'm not a finger, but I'm feeling through my finger. Who is it? We say, my body, my ears. We don't say, I ears, or I body. This body is like a vehicle, according to the Gita. Some people may have a Mercedes, some people may have an Ambassador, some people may have a Maruti, some people may have a Ford. Some may have an old car, some may have a brand new car. But actually, what makes the car important is the driver. The purpose of the car is to serve the purpose of the driver, who's seeing through the windshield and making it go right and left and honking the horn. We are that person. And the body and the mind are temporary vehicles for the soul, the Atma. And the Gita tells us that the Atma is eternal, full of knowledge and full of happiness, spiritual happiness. It doesn't die with the body. I was just speaking to Sunil, who's personally my favorite bank in the world is HSBC. And I'll tell you why, and then remind me what I'm talking about. Huh? You'll have to give me a loan to do that. And I don't have much credit ratings either. But I spoke at HSBC Bank in May of, or April of last year, and also in October. And I remember those so special. They welcomed me with so gracious hospitality at Canary Wharf in London. And there were 900 bankers assembled. And I was asked to speak on unity in diversity. The idea was, it's a celebration of holy, and holy is unity and diversity. And the bankers were telling me, Mr. Kaman and several others, that we have people who work in the bank who are from China, from Japan, from Africa, from America, from India, from, there are so many nationalities, so many religions, so many people of varieties. And we want to try to create unity and respect among those varieties. So I said a little prayer. What should I say? Because I don't prepare so much. So I only went to one semester of a junior college before I went to the Himalayas. Ended up in a cave studying cobras and leopards and mosquitoes. A lot of monkeys. They were my classmates. But anyways, I began the talk by saying, I'm so honored to be with all of you. This is one of the greatest banks in the world, and you are among the greatest bankers in the world. And honestly, I have not had a bank account since 1969. And I haven't signed a check since 1969. And you're asking me to speak to you how to improve the quality of your life. And I had this garland, the idea of unity and diversity. What makes this garland so beautiful is so many different colors, different textures. We have red, we have yellow, we have pink, we have white, we have orange. They have different fragrances. But there's a string that binds all the different flowers together. We don't see the string, but it's what makes the combination so beautiful. So on the external level, we have so many differences with each other. But what is that string that can bind us together? It's the string of wisdom. To understand, if we understand really who I am, then we can understand our true relationship with all others. There's a verse in Bhagavad Gita. When I was just a teenage boy wandering around the world and I came to India, when I heard this verse, I thought, this is it. This is what I need to know, this is what I need to realize, and this is what the world needs. We can talk about world peace, we can talk about unity, but this verse really tells, it's the string that could bring us all together to be a beautiful garland, mala. And the verse is Vidyavanaya Sampane Brahmani Gavihasti Suni Chaiva Supakicha Pandita Samadarshana. What is wisdom? What is knowledge? It's not just superimposing data in our brain. Real knowledge, Pandit, from the Gita's perspective, is the capacity to see every living being with equal vision. Whether one is male or female, black, white, red, yellow, or brown. Whether one is a Hindu or a Muslim or a Christian or a Jew or a Jain or a Sikh or a Parsi or an agnostic or an atheist. Whether is rich or poor, Eastern or Western, whether one is a human or an elephant or a cow or a dog or a cat. When we understand who I am, that living force, and how sacred that living force is within us. Krishna says in Gita, Mamayavam so jivaloke jivabhuta sanatana, that every living being is a part of God, like the ray of a sun is part of the sun. It gives light, it gives heat. It's not different from the sun. It's a sacred part. If we understand the sacredness of our own eternal identity, and nothing can change that. There is nothing the world can do to change the beautiful, blissful, eternal nature of ourself. And there's nothing we can do to change that. However many crimes we commit, or however much piety we perform, we cannot change that. Who is it? What is it? It's beautiful. The potential of infinite love, of infinite compassion, of infinite happiness is who we are. But unfortunately, we've forgotten for so long, and we're so diverted to identifying and trying to find pleasure in so many other ways. We welcome you. Thank you for coming. You're just on time, actually. When we recognize the beauty of our true identity, we can rise above all arrogance. We can rise above all inferiority complexes and depression. And it's no longer that we have to get things from outside to fulfill our need for satisfaction. But we find true satisfaction from within, because it's who we are. We're a sacred part of God that intimately loves God, and that intimately loves every living being as a sacred part of God. When we see it in ourselves, we see it in everyone. Whatever kind of car they're driving, we see a brother, we have a sister, we love people. That is wisdom. And that wisdom is not something that is acquired according to the Gita. Jeev jago, goda chandra bole. That wisdom is something that's uncovered, something that's awakened. Socrates, the great Greek philosopher, this was his principle, that real knowledge is already within you. It just has to be uncovered. And so many of us, when we actually hear from a guru or read from a scripture and we're actually tuned in, it doesn't sound like something foreign. It's the most familiar thing.
I remember when I was hearing the wisdom of the Vedas, I was thinking, this is the most familiar thing I've ever heard. I just never thought of it before. Uncovered.
I was speaking the other day about how in today's world, technology has brought us to such heights of potential. And technology, science, economic powers, whatever it may be, it, from a spiritual perspective, it's neither negative or positive. It's neutral. What makes it negative or positive is the consciousness of the person who's operating it. An example is a knife. Is a knife good or bad? If a knife is in the hands of a thief and he kills someone to rob them, then the knife is bad. But if the knife is in the hands of a surgeon who saves a person's life out of compassion, then the knife is very good. And everything is like that. This is the principle of yukta vairagya, that whatever our position, whether we are kings, whether we have so much, or whether we're very simple living on a farm, according to our consciousness, according to how we're tuned in to who we really are, we could be instruments of grace with whatever we have. When I was young, in America, I was born in 1950, and everyone in America, in those days, I guess it's the same today, they loved to watch television. So, but the television shows in those days were quite innocent compared to today. So I lived about 30 miles north of Chicago in a little village, and there was one television in the house. It was a black and white TV in my mother and father's room, and the whole family would gather together sometimes at night, and just we'd be on the floor and they'd be on their beds and we'd watch. So they'd only do family shows, which were kind of very innocent for everyone. And if you wanted to change the channel, I hate to tell you what we had to do. We had to get up from the bed. We had to walk across the whole room. We had to turn the channel with our hand, with a dial. And then once you turn the channel, it's a different frequency. So then you had to manipulate the antenna, which was like this. We'd have to go, we'd be going, the picture would go, and we go, and then go, okay. Now people lay in their beds eating potato chips or whatever else, and they just, you know, 100 channels. One channel, there it is, the news from Egypt. And you're actually watching what's going on in Egypt live. And then, live cricket game in Brazil or Australia. There's Brazil, soccer game. And then, there's some Bollywood movie from 1950. So we're just sitting. Isn't it incredible? It's really incredible. How you just press a button and you're getting a whole new sound and a whole new picture. How is it possible? It's not that you call in and say, you know, I want to see this particular show, and they say, well, you'll have to wait, you know, 8 hours till we send it to you. That means all the frequencies, hundreds of frequencies, are right around we, but we can't see it. We can't feel it. We can't access it unless we tune in to the right channel, to the right frequency. And we learn from spiritual acharyas and from the holy scriptures that every type of frequency is everywhere. Because every person is like an antenna
that's both receiving and emitting. Every time we get angry and say something very bad about somebody, then that we are putting anger into the universe. Every time we're very compassionate and want to help somebody, we're putting compassion into the universe. That energy, that frequency. Even from science, everything, when it comes down to its fundamental, you know, existence, it's energy. This creation is big, built on energy. And we're emitting energy with our every thought, every word, and every action. And then there is the composite energy of these different things. There's the energy of the collective anger of the world, of the collective envy and arrogance and greed. And if we become greedy, we're tuning in to access the universal greed that's within this world. And if we're charitable, we're tuning in to that. What is Dharma? Dharma is to tune in to the transcendental spiritual energies that are everywhere within us and without us. And bhakti, which is the path that I follow, bhakti is the process of tuning in to the most powerful, nourishing, and healing of all energies. The energy of grace. Grace is the love, the benevolence of the Supreme, of Krishna, of Radha, of Ram. When we tune into that energy of grace, it heals us, it purifies us, and it awakens the grace within us. We can be instruments. Once we tune into that grace, we become like an antenna in whatever we do to bring grace to the world. And how do we access it? It's everywhere. We can't access to it until we tune into it. And that's the purpose of spiritual life. When we perform our spiritual practices, whether it's a ritual, a puja, whether it's reading the holy scriptures, whether it's satsang or associating with a holy person, whether it's meditation. The Vedas explain in this age of Kali, the most powerful way to tune in is to chant God's names. Hari Kirtan. What are we doing? If we're actually in the right consciousness, seeking the essence while we perform these practices, we're tuning in to the most powerful energy in all of creation, the power of love, the power of grace. And we could be an instrument of that. And that's so important. We have with us so many special people today, Radha Krishna Prabhu and his good wife Palika Devi. He was one of the top dentists in all of Bombay. He has a degree in dental surgery, and he was fixing people's teeth and all of that. And he was making good living, and he had a nice house and everything. And he was, I think, the president of the Lions Club or something. He was the president of the Lions Club. And he wanted to dedicate his life to seva, and now he is finding so much satisfaction just tuning into that grace and letting that grace manifest through him. And just by his humble efforts, he's in the ghetto schools. It was actually the government of India that asked to help because children were dropping out of school due to hunger. And he's just by the kitchens that he's personally opened and overseeing. 260,000 children are being given very, very nourishing foods He was a dentist, dental, and now he has become transcendental. And he doesn't really want anything for himself. That's beautiful. We have here Gaurangaji, my very dear friend. You were telling me you were his batchmate. I'm his batchmate now. So he's IIT graduate, and he's travels around the world enlightening people in Dharma, and literally thousands of people, their lives are being transformed. People in business, people in politics, people in trade, people who are... It's not... Dharma is not a matter of changing our position. Dharma is just changing our hearts from the obsessive need to get and get and get to the love of using what I have to give. This is human evolution. Human evolution is not from going from being a monkey to a human. Human evolution of consciousness is evolving from the need to take to the joy to give. And when that love awakens in our heart, compassion, the greatest need in the world, it makes everything work. And it's interesting how even many of the biggest people in the Western world, they're coming to understand that this is the most important thing, and that the most important quality of a leader is the desire to serve with compassion. And I'll end with one little story that I think I told the other night at your house, Keshava. I was giving a lecture here in Bombay some years ago. It was in a college of accountants. Yes, certified, chartered accountants, whatever it may be. And there was about 300 students in the auditorium. And I gave my lecture. I don't give such good lectures, but whatever I said, I said. And I asked, is there questions that anyone would like to ask? And when you're in a college in Bombay, you have to be prepared for anything when you ask for questions. And I traveled for many years giving college lectures in University of America, and if there's one thing that students love is when the teacher is defeated. So this one young man raised his hands, and I called him, and he stood up, and everyone in the room, I understood this person is quite popular. He started screaming at me with such anger and vengeance. He said, "You are a cheater. You have simply come to mislead us. I reject everything you've said. What if everybody in the world became a swami like you? Who would do the banking? Who would grow the food? Who would run the governments? Who would do the business and trade? You are rejected." He got a standing ovation. All 300 students were howling and woo, and they were clapping and they were on their feet. And I couldn't say anything, it was so loud. After about a minute or so, it calmed down. And I said a little prayer. Krishna, how do you want me to answer this question? It wasn't even a question, it was a challenge. I said, "Sir, what if everyone in the world became an accountant like you? Who would do the banking? Who would grow the food? Who would run the governments or do the trading.
In fact, if everyone in the world became an accountant like you,
there would be 100% unemployment. Because no one would need an accountant. When I said that, I have to be a little humble when I tell you this, I got a bigger standing ovation than you. And then I continued. I said, actually, we need farmers and we need bankers and business people and we need scientists and engineers and we need students and mothers and fathers and we need accountants. We need politicians. And there's also a need for little swamis like me. It's like the body. This human body has so many parts. And all the parts have different shapes, different colors, different textures, and different functions. The liver cannot do what the nose does. Yes? The kidneys cannot do what the ears do. The eyes cannot do what the heart does. The feet cannot do what the mouth does. But is it that one part of the body is saying, I am high caste, you are low? You feet, you're so low. You're on the ground. I'm the nose, I'm on the top. Is it that the parts of the body are fighting egoistically, competing? Every part of the body is serving every other part of the body. Because we understand the necessity of unity. And according to the Vedic literatures, the idea of Varnashram Dharma is not some sectarian conception that, you know, where the high people repress the low people. Everyone has value. And to recognize and appreciate each other's value and to actually work together with that appreciation is what makes a healthy body. And in order to actually understand that deeply, substantially, it's very crucial that we understand our own essence and recognize that in others. And this is so much a great need for a meaningful fulfillment in life and so much necessary for real unity and peace within the world. Thank you very much. If anyone would like to ask any questions or say anything, I'm happy. I'm ready for anything. Please, please.
What's culture?
What is culture? Culture can be explained from different perspectives. The one very important idea regarding that is culture is based on values. And in our educational systems today in the world, it's oftentimes so critically lacking that we give our children so much technology and data to, you know, accomplish things. But if we don't give them values, universal values, actual spiritual values, then what will they do for themselves and what will they do for the world? Culture is when it is like the string that brings people together, talents together, on the basis of value.
art, music, literature, science, technology, architecture. If we have values behind these things, that is great culture. What was it that a British man asked Mahatma Gandhi, "What do you think of Western culture?" And Gandhi said, "I think it's a good idea." Because he saw, you know, from his perspective, he saw incredible military technology and scientific technology and a lot of economic growth, but he didn't see core values. And that's a very important part of culture. Spiritual culture is what we're talking about when it's actually in action, when it's being expressed. Does that answer your question?
I wanted to say something.
Please, please.
I wanted to comment, not to hardly any answer for that.
No question.
It's not a question. But I just wanted to comment. The scriptures, Indian scriptures, and Indian religion, religious interpretation, have some limitations. One, God created man on his own model, that we will behave like God. Man thought, that is very different. So why not start worshipping him, give him some flowers, commit some crime, do whatever you want. And the Indian religion has given its support to this interpretation of theory, that you commit a crime, go to a temple, and you are redeemed. I don't know what is the situation. Number two, I have written something in which Ravan said on the day of Dasara, Ram, that don't celebrate. You have failed the Sita. You killed one Ravan. I did nothing to your Sita in Lanka. Why? If you have the courage, you put any Sita on the road and she will not be safe. Do you think that you have killed me? You have immortalized me. I am now present in every heart of human being. I don't know why. Right from the days of Krishna or Ram, always the religious system has failed, and you can say sin has always won. Temporarily, religion wins. While some Krishna comes, some Ram comes, what is the systemic problem in that? What is the systemic failure in that religious system? What is wrong in our interpretation? Because of which we do something which is not required by religion, and we misinterpret religion too. Justify our wrongdoings. What is the reason behind that? Compassion. The compassion with which all our spiritual leaders are trying to solve the problems of the world. Even Krishna found that this has limitation. He could not redeem the character of Duryodhana. Despite all his best efforts, ultimately Mahabharata could not be prevented. I feel the same compassion has got the same type of limitation even today. So, how do you think that it is going to solve the problems that we are facing? We find that Harvard is producing so many best management graduates. The result is depression, and not once, twice. Similar things are happening everywhere. I find that those who are more intelligent will invent some management theory or financial jargons to take the money out of the poor's pocket or out of the pockets of the less intelligent people who are not so manipulative and all those things. It has been coming since, I mean, thousands of years, and it is going on. Nothing is preventing it. I simply want to comment on that. Thank you.
You are very welcome. Spoken from your heart. Oh, I first after
reply, what you're saying is so very true. And it's very important that we go to the root of the problem. That the Supreme Lord is Abhigya and Swarat. He's all-knowing and he's independent. And as jivas, as eternal sacred souls, we also have free will. And God never interferes with someone's free will. Yada yada hi dharmasya glanir bhavati bharata bhutanam dharmasya tadatmanam srijanyaham. The Lord descends into this world, but he never interferes with the free will. He just tells us, this is what you have to do to be happy. This is what you have to do to be free from all the karma that's going to come on you. Sarva dharman purichasya. This is what every great saint, every great avatar, and every great scripture teaches us, how to transform our lives. But we have free will. We can accept it or not. Krishna personally went. He's the Supreme Absolute Truth. He showed his Virat Rupa, his universal form, to Duryodhana. When he came to Duryodhana's palace, he came to try to convince Duryodhana, just be fair. Just be moral. Just give some honor and respect to the Pandavas and avoid this battle. And Duryodhana sent his soldiers to arrest Krishna and put him in jail. And Krishna just, he showed his universal form. And all the soldiers ran away. And Duryodhana ran away. But still, Krishna told him, just be kind. Just be moral. Just be honest. Stop this war. But Duryodhana, no. Because he had that free will. Ultimately, he was destroyed. But he had that free will. And that free will is within all of us. And the Bhagavad Gita describes that we all have, in this world, until we attain that perfect state of spiritual purity, we have a divine nature and a demoniac nature. And they're both dictating to us. But we have the choice which one we are going to follow. There's an example that there are two dogs living in every heart. There is a good dog and there is a bad dog. The difference between the two, the bad dog is barking arrogance, the good dog humility, greed, generosity, hate, love, selfishness, compassion, anger, forgiveness. Yes? Don't we all have that? It's like a battle between the good dog and the bad dog. And which of those dogs is going to win? Some of us, because we've been feeding by the choices we make, we feed the bad dog so much by giving in to these lower tendencies, dishonesty, envy, greed, anger, lust. That the bad dog is really, really strong. And he's barking very loud. Sometimes he's howling. Have you seen? And the good dog, been neglected so long. Like that. Ravana, his dog was barking. Bad dog. But the good dog was also there. But Ravana did. He made the wrong choices. Which dog we feed by the choices we make moment to moment is which dog's going to prevail over the other. And yes, the bad dog, which is like Ravana, is immortalized in a sense that it's there in everyone's heart, on the streets. Sita is the property of God, the sacred property of the Lord. How do we view the sacred property of the Lord? How do we honor and respect the sacredness of life? That's what determines whether we're going to be nourishing the Hanuman in our heart or the Ravana in our heart. We have both of them. And as we make good choices, we become purified. Our dharma becomes strong. And that's what the Lord descends in every religion to teach us. But unfortunately, it's all too common throughout history of every religion that people use their religion as a tool to satisfy the bad dog. But the whole purpose of religion is to starve the bad dog, but we use it to feed it. I'm better. We're arrogant. We're envious. We're greedy. So my religion is better than yours. Therefore, you are inferior to me. You should die. I should take whatever you have because you have no right to it. And what happens is our greed and our envy and our arrogance put the badge of religion on it, and it has absolute authority in our mind, and we can justify anything. Misguided religion is one of the most dangerous, horrible things in the history of humanity. But properly guided religion is the most beautiful, healing, purifying blessing to humanity. Does that not answer your question, but does that respond to what you said? But if we have good association of people reminding us, association gives us strength. Just like, if I can just say one thing. Recently, one of my friends brought me to his Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And those people have some serious bad dogs. Because have you ever been to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting? What they do is when every one of them, when they stand up, they say their name and they say, "I am an alcoholic." Even somebody has been sober for 30 years and has not touched alcohol or drugs, they'll still say, my name is, and I am an alcoholic. The idea is the tendency is there, and we have to recognize it. And they speak about all the terrible atrocities that they have done when they were alcoholics. And it's really intense how they were beating their wives, how they were beating their children, how they... From being wealthy, they ended up with nothing. Their cruelties, their abominableness. And it was just that alcohol could really, really feed that bad dog and make a spark like a blazing fire. And coming together with each other to remind each other, to give each other strength, to give each other clarity, has cured tens and millions of alcoholics because they help each other. And that's the purpose of satsang. That's the purpose of culture. That's the purpose of society. To have friends and loved ones who help to actually nourish each other, overcome each other's anarthas or unwanted qualities, and nourish our good qualities. And that's the purpose of sadhana, or our spiritual practice. If it's done right, if we practice religion and it's just without understanding its purpose. The purpose, our Gurudev, Srila Prabhupada, my beloved Gurudev, he said, real religion, real spirituality is not about being a Hindu or a Muslim or a Jain or a Jew or a Sikh or a Parsi. Real religion is about loving God, accessing the love of God within our heart and living with the character of compassion to all beings. That is religion, whatever you want to call it. If our chanting of the holy names is not for that purpose, if our puja is not for that purpose, and if it's not creating that character, then it's misguided. And it's very common for people to seek superficial things and miss the essence, miss the purpose. But to whatever extent, each and every one of us could be an instrument to inspire that. That's the greatest thing in the world. If we can help even one person to find that love within their heart and to be an instrument of that love, if we can help one person to live a better, more fulfilling, and more spiritually connected life, that's a tremendous thing in this world. If we can feed that good dog in ourselves, and if we can help feed that good dog in somebody else, that's beautiful. Whether we can help one person or whether we can help 100 million people. Integrity in life is that we're trying to do the right thing. Not that there's so much problem, what could I do, so I'll just be a part of it. That's the reason the world is in such a difficult situation. Because bad people are really enthusiastic and so many good people think there's nothing I can do about it. But there is something we can do about it. Yes?
Hey, I actually had a question with regard to your comments on pleasure, that, you know, everybody in this world is looking for pleasure, whether it's the elephant or, you know, other animals and human beings. And to get pleasure, you know, one is trying to avoid pain, is the other point you mentioned.
Such an attentive student.
This morning I was actually sitting with my son who's 9 years, and I guess in my own little way I try and feed the good dog in my children, and hopefully, you know, that is a, you know, beautiful experience for me, hoping to, you know, create good human beings. And I found myself telling him that to get pleasure, he was giving me an example of some good grade he'd gotten class and how hard he'd worked, etc. I was very proud, and also emphasizing that he'd worked hard. So I found myself telling him that to get pleasure, you have to go through some amount of pain in life. And that is a practical teaching I was sharing with him. But listening to you, I found myself contradicting, in giving him a message which was actually contradicting a little bit of what you said, that we should avoid pain to get more pleasure, right, to increase pleasure. However, I found myself telling him that to get pleasure, you have to go through pain. So whether you want to come first in a race, you have to practice, and it's hard work, and it might be painful, but eventually it gives you joy. The elephant which you were talking about, you know, has to walk and go through some amount of pain to get to pleasure. So is that correct? Am I right or wrong in saying that you have to, that pain precedes pleasure?
Tapo divyam putrakayena sattvam sujedyasyam brahmasokyam tvanantam. Tapo, or tapasya, that means to be willing to undergo obstacles, difficulties, to achieve a higher principle. That's the actual culture and integrity of a real human being. Yes, what you told your son is very nice. Doesn't contradict what I was saying. It's very important. Because that bad dog is, when the bad dog is howling,
when something in our minds wants revenge on somebody, then it's a tapasya to not follow it. No pain, no gain. Yes? Nothing is accomplished, material or spiritual, without struggle. What is the meaning of integrity? It's the integrity is to make the choice between what is right and what is easy. Because the easy thing is usually wrong. To do something right is like swimming upstream in the river of this world. And to do the things wrong is very much like floating downstream. Because that's just the way the world is these days. But actually, even though it may be a struggle, even though it may be painful, this is what I was saying, and it is. To do the right thing is tapasya. To rise early in the morning to chant God's names or to do our sadhana may be a little painful. To be honest when you could make a lot more money if you're dishonest is painful. But that pain brings inner satisfaction. It brings inner fulfillment because it brings meaning to our life. To endure pain for the right thing it's a very nice ringer to endure pain to be compassionate to others to be faithful to the will of God is actually the greatest pleasure of the heart. There was a great saint named Bhaktivinoda Thakur. He was during the British time. He was a British, he was a magistrate. He was a judge in a court and very highly regarded and respected by the government. He had 10 children. He had a wife, Bhagavati, who was a very saintly lady. And he raised his children so beautifully. And of all the judges in Bengal and Orissa in those days, he was in charge of the Jagannath Temple. He had such incredible dignity and integrity and such intelligence and strength of character that they put him in charge of the whole area of Jagannath Puri in Orissa. And they, wherever there were serious problems, the government would relocate him there because he was so expert and so fearless. And he was such... Even though he was dealing with government matters and he was running government problem situations and he was a judge in the courtroom and he took perfect notes and he had 10 children and he raised them all with encouragement and happiness. He was an incredible person. He wrote dozens and dozens of books, hundreds and hundreds of beautiful prayers and songs. He was a guru for tens and thousands of people. While he was doing all the rest of these things. Such an example. But he wrote something very beautiful. With tears in his eyes, he prayed, "My dear Lord, the pains and difficulties I undergo in serving you with love are the greatest pleasures of my life." Just like a mother. You're a mother for your child. How old is your child?
Nine.
So when your child is sick and keeps you up all night long, it's painful, isn't it? You have to be up all night long and you're feeding him, you're worrying about him, he has a fever and all of these things. But even though physically and mentally it may be very, very difficult, if you just said, you know, I want to be peaceful. I want to be happy. Let my child suffer. I'm going to go to sleep. Would that make you happy inside? Mentally, you're sleeping, you're happy. But your heart's not happy. Even though you're suffering, trying to take care of them, because that suffering is out of love and compassion, it's actually meaningful. It's fulfilling. And actually, it brings inner happiness because you're suffering for the higher purpose of love. Does that answer your question? You're welcome. Yes, sir.
I also want your comment. That's a element.
Number one, I read somewhere that life is a journey between pleasure and pain. It's neither pleasure nor pain, but it has to be mixed and there has to be a balance. So that's number one thing on which I want to seek your opinion. Curious. Number two, the main differentiator between human and divine is that we have greed, lust, as human beings, for various things, various objects. Whereas divine or God is completely above this. They do not have any lust or any desire. Just now, while talking about Sita, you said that she was the property of the Lord. Sita is worshipped all across India, at least in countries which profess, which there is sizable Hindu population, or wherever there is Hindu population. But how did she have the desire for the skin of the golden deer? And you know, the desire or the lust was of such a magnitude, which involved sniffing life out of a living being. You couldn't have got the golden skin without killing the deer. So here you find that the differentiator between the human being and the divine is slightly getting blurred. And there's another third small point, that the God writes our destiny, ways, lives, what we are going to do, in what yoni or what form we will acquire. So God writes our destiny, Brahma, or the God as such, He writes the destiny of the human being. But what we find in the real life is that man starts imitating God and the problem starts. We want to write the destiny of the wife, of the who your partner. If you are the Lord, the God yourself, you want to write the destiny of your child. You want to mold your child as per your wishes or desire. Again, in the workplace, you may be slightly more fortunate than your other colleagues. So if you help, you feel as if you are writing their destiny. And this desire to play the God, what is the God's role, and the desire inside the human being to play the God. When your son or a daughter doesn't follow your dictates, you feel unhappy. They may be doing the right thing. They may be doing the thing which is current or which gives them happiness. But you feel unhappy because your presumption that you
or God and your desires should be fulfilled or your dictates should be carried out is giving you pain. So the playing of the God and the pain associated with not being fulfilled on this account, on all the opinions. So I want your views or comments on these points.
I will try. You said so many things I don't know if I... But as far as Sita, I've studied Ramayana for many, many years, and I've studied under many saintly people, and Sita didn't want the skin of the deer. She wanted the deer. And she wanted to, her idea was, because it was getting close to the end of their exile, she wanted to bring the, because the deer was so beautiful looking, she wanted to bring the deer back to Ayodhya. But it was a good desire. She wanted to have, give the deer a very beautiful life in the palace of Ayodhya and to be with the deer. So she didn't want to kill the deer. She actually wanted to serve the deer and feed the deer and play with the deer and give her love to the deer. She's the embodiment of divine love. What blessing, what grace she wanted to bestow on the deer. I mean, if I could be a deer in Sita's garden, I would be very happy. Sita coming every day and petting you. So it was her love, it was her compassion. She didn't want to kill the deer. And as far as the second part? Okay, the desire to play God. This is in the fifth chapter of the Gita. In essence, this is addressed with a beautiful verse. Bhoktaram jagatapasam sarvalokameheshwaram suhridam sarvabhutaram gyatvaman shanti mechchati. The Gita, this is the peace formula. According to this great scripture, this is the simple method of attaining peace. To understand three things. That God is the proprietor of everything. Sarva-lokameshwara. That means all the planets and all the universes and everything in within all planets of the universe is the property of God. We are entrusted with God's property. But we are not God, nor are we the proprietors of anything. Just like if you're the proprietor of a house, nobody could kick you out of it. But if somebody else is the proprietor, they can tell you to go. Of course, in India, with the laws, it's a little more difficult. But ultimately, this body, if we can control the body, we can just say, body, do not grow old. Body, do not die. The fact that the body's growing old means the body is controlled by nature. And the fact that the body has to die means the body is controlled by nature, by time. And Krishna says, mayadhyakshena prakriti. He is the source and the ultimate ruler of nature. So, liberation is when we give up the false conception, the Gita says, that I am the proprietor, that I am the enjoyer. Krishna says, I am the proprietor of everything, I am the enjoyer of all sacrifices, and that he is the best well-wishing friend of all living beings. If we can connect with the love of God and be an instrument of God, then we can be an instrument of his friendship. But if we think it's me that's going to save somebody, me that's going to help somebody. Our children are God's children entrusted under our care to love and protect on God's behalf. Our property is God's property to take care of and to utilize in harmony with God's will. That's the liberated state. But as long as we think I am the God, I am the proprietor, and I am controller, and we use things in a whimsical way, then there'll be so much frustration. So yes, we are disappointed when our children do something wrong, and we're happy when our children do something right, and we're trying to guide them. We can't make anyone's destiny. God ultimately puts us in this world and gives us free will, and ultimately our destiny is according to the choices we make. On Sunday, I'm getting on an airplane to go to Moscow. And once I'm on that airplane, if I tell the airline hostess, I want to go to Singapore, she said, well, the plane's going to Moscow. I say, I have my free will. This is a free country and a free world. I want to go to Singapore. She'll say, you had your free will to get on this plane or another plane, but once you're on the plane, once you make the choice, you have no free will of where you're going. So we may have the free will if we hurt somebody. We have no free will after that, what the reaction will be. We're going to have to suffer that karma. If I do the free will of doing good to somebody, we're going to get that karma. But what our reaction is to the reaction is what our future destiny is. That's a principle that we should all know, that we're responsible for every word and every choice we make. And that's what our destiny is going to be. And whatever is within our charge, our wife, our husband, our children, our family, our property, our countrymen, to think that this is mine is the illusion. We are entrusted with these people, entrusted with these responsibilities on behalf of God. I say this at marriage lectures all the time, that it's not that this is your wife and this is your husband. That's there, but it's more than that. This lady is a sacred, beloved daughter of God entrusted in your care. And how you treat your wife is how you treat God. Because it's God's daughter. Right? If somebody mistreats your daughter, they're mistreating you, are they not? And this is not just your husband. This is God's beloved son entrusted in your care to nourish and protect and to inspire. And these are not just your children. They are your children, but at a deeper level, these are God's precious children, eternal souls, who are being entrusted in your care to take care of on behalf of God. Huh? This is spiritual investment. This type of balance, if you have this consciousness, you can attain spiritual perfection just by being a father and a mother and a husband and a wife. Yes, yes. Of course.
I'll keep it very short. On the comparison with knives, you gave an example of the knife, and it depends on how a human being uses it. Question to you. First one, are you in favor of gun control? That's question one. Question two, you talked about joy of giving. Recently, Warren Buffett came to India. It didn't look like he created a lot of wave about philanthropy. And the reason was, everybody said, at least the media said, that India is in an economic cycle where people have not yet captured enough wealth or possessed enough wealth to give. Do you see giving as a part of first having and then giving? And one of the reasons why Indian rich are not in the top list of philanthropy is that. Two short questions.
I'm not so expert at those kind of questions, actually. But the first one was? Gun control. I don't really know all the political arguments on both sides, but it's a big debate in India too. I know in the West it's very... Charleston Heston, who was Jesus in the Ten Commandments and Moses in the Ten... He was Moses in the Ten Commandments. He played Jesus in the life of Jesus. And he played Ben-Hur. He was... He's like... Of all Hollywood actors, he's considered to be the person who played the biggest, holiest roles. And he's the face of the American Rifle Association to protect the rights of every citizen to own their own guns. Yeah. The principle of ahimsa should be understood carefully. Ahimsa is one of the deepest of all subjects. Ahimsa is based on compassion. To not cause harm to any living being, either through our thoughts, our words, or our actions. Amani namana dena, to honor and respect the life of everyone, the values of everyone. And it is on the basis of ahimsa that so many people of our faith are vegetarian, because we extend it beyond just human. We actually feel for the suffering of others. A saintly person is paradukaduki, which means the pain of another is my pain, and the happiness of another is my happiness. That's culture. That's evolution of consciousness. Not just how we dress or what kind of car we drive or what kind of house we live in. Whether those things are neutral, but how we actually feel compassion for other beings. That's advancement of civilization. And that's what brings real fulfillment. So with gun control, it's a political subject. It's a government-type subject of how laws are going to be enacted. From a spiritual perspective, which is my role in life, you know, I'm not going to tell you where to invest your money because I have no idea what to invest in. but I can tell how to invest your consciousness, because that's a spiritual principle, and that's Krishna tells in Gita, better to perform your own duty, honestly, than another duty, another person's duty, even if it's expert. So the idea with guns is, if they're actually being used to protect and to stop violence, then they have merit. But if they're going to be used to impel violence, you know, some people are going to get guns and they're going to be criminals. They have something by which they could kill somebody they're angry with, they could rob stores. And there are millions and millions of people who use guns for the purpose of violence. And there are other people who have guns to actually protect nonviolence, to protect the innocent from violence. That's the principle. And the people who want guns to be legal are saying, we need guns to protect ourselves from people who have guns. We need to arm ourselves against evil people for the purpose of good. Yes? But the problem is, when the law, that may be a positive thing to some people, but when the law is there, it gives facility for so many, 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 many more bad people to have guns.
So that's a political problem, and whether I'm for one or the other, I'm for ahimsa in whatever way it works. I think the governments should work out which is the best thing, but my inclination is to have very, very restrictive gun laws, because I think there's more bad dogs barking for guns than good dogs barking for guns. So I think, you know, there's a place for guns to protect people who have them, who have that wrong ambition. But I think very strong restrictions are very, very necessary to curb crime in the world. And your second question was?
Just the fact that in India, philanthropy is still not seen as a very...
Warren Buffett and all that.
Yeah, so he came and it wasn't like... He's a rage for investors. He wasn't a rage for philanthropists in the country. Because everybody thought that... I mean, America talks about giving, or let's say Warren Buffett talks about giving with $100 billion. In India, it is still not seen as such a virtuous thing. People do it, but it's not a rage. Why? Because people have enough to live comfortably.
India's Dharma Bhumi, Dharma Kshetra. It's the land of Dharma. Throughout history, India has established the principle of Dharma for the whole world. And Dharma has many levels. There's Tamaguna, Rajaguna, Sattvaguna, and Sudhasattva, the pure spiritual Dharma, the Sarva Dharman Parityasya. And most people use their money for Rajaguna, Tamaguna in the modes of darkness and passion. And Dharma is actually to understand that this is God's money. Fortune, Lakshmi is the goddess of fortune. She's God's energy, Sita. To be selfish is to enjoy some things in this world, but to deprive oneself of real fulfillment, real happiness, real purpose, and real enlightenment. So, from my perspective, I was born and raised in America, and I've been living in India more or less since 1970, for the past 42 years. And what I see is the deepest, holiest culture on all the planet in India. And when people of the West, you know, show the quality of charity and concern for others, I think Warren Buffett is coming to, whether he knows it or not, he's coming to remind India of who we are and what we represent to the world. And I think we should take that seriously. We may not have as much as him. But all of us, whether we have a little or whether we have a lot, we should all understand that sharing with our brothers and sisters, charity begins at home, but beyond that, to share with the world, and para upakar, to invest money not only for the physical and emotional happiness of other people within society, but for the spiritual enlightenment of people's society. Watering the root of people's real need. That's so important. According to the Vedas, and this is very interesting, if you read the Mahabharata, the Ramayana, the Upanishads, the Gita, according to the Vedic literatures, most of the principles that are taught to family people is charity.
It's the most prominent of all rules, recommendations for people who are in family is to be charitable. Because the tendency in family is to be obsessed with your own little thing and to be selfish. It's like an inbred tendency when we're making money and we're working hard and we have, you know, our own needs, to be very insulated and selfish. So to counteract that tendency, all of our scriptures, what is the difference between a grihamedi and a grihasta? Grihamedi means a person who is very much entrenched in the material concepts of their family, and a grihasta is an enlightened person. It's charity. In the Vedic civilization, before a family man or woman even eats, it was a rule, and people used to do it. You have to go outside your house and cry out, if anyone's hungry, please come and we'll feed you. And after you feed everyone, then the family eats. And I know people of past generations that actually did that. Now that may not be literally possible right now, where you go out and say, anybody eat, and your family has to serve everybody. But the principle is important, not the literal execution. The principle is to be charitable. The principle is to share what we have, whether it's a little or a lot. That's dharma. That elevates the family to a much higher. God has entrusted this to me, not only to me and my family, but God has entrusted it to my greater family, to God's family. And that's a beautiful thing. And that's what India really is. Bharat Bhumi, Dharma Bhumi. That's what I hitchhiked from London through 6 months of ordeals and near-death experiences and heavy diseases like I never knew before. I came to India to find that. What is Dharma? What is love of God? That's what India has. That's our heritage. And if Warren Buffett comes to remind us, I think whether we're billionaires or millionaires or whether we're just little shopkeepers, the principle is who we are and what we should represent.
Incredible 2 hours, but all good things have to come to an end. An interesting thing, I don't know whether you noticed, we had 2 3-year-olds and 1 82-year-old. I promise you, they were neither sleeping nor shouting. And they were here for 2 hours. It was incredible. So thank you for this. Prasad will discuss in just 5 minutes. Please take Prasad before you all go. And thank you. I know it's a weekday. And it's tough to come and spend time on weekday evening in Bombay. And thank you all for coming. Before you leave, Nandini's book is there outside, Journey Home. You collect a copy and small write-up on midday meal, which Bharat has brought along with us. So please collect that and thank you for coming. Thank you so much.
And Sunil and Anu, thank you so very, very much. You're such beautiful people. And Kushal and Nupur, thank you for making all this possible for me. These are two such of the most beautiful people I've ever known, Kushal and Nupur. I've known them about 30 years or something. When Kushal was in college, he was going to Wharton Business School at the University of Pennsylvania. I used to come down by train, and we would meet at the Penn Station. What was it called? 30th Street Station. And I would personally cook samosas and bring them to him because students are usually hungry in America. And in those days, samosas, I don't know if we got them anywhere else. But they're just, you know, they really, this family, I mean, I'm just meeting all of you, but I've known this young couple since they've been married and before, and they really strive to live by these principles that we're talking about, and it's
so deeply, deeply proud of you. Since you said all those things about me, I get to say something. And to all of you, it's really such an honor. I'm so grateful to be with you. Thank you for accepting whatever little offerings I try to share with you. Thank you.